You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
So let me just give you a little bit of background about why I chose Desiderata as a topic. And I'd like you to go back in your minds, those of you who are old enough, those who are younger, to the 1970s, 1971, kind of the middle or the height of the, I suppose you could call it the hippie revolution in a way. My generation's way of stretching our wings and flexing our muscles and deciding that the age of Aquarius was upon us and we were going to do things differently than the previous generations. So back in 1971, the tribal musical hair was in Australia. It's hard. Has anybody seen that? Great. At that time, friend Helen invited me to join a couple of her friends and herself on a trip to Melbourne to see the musical. And I can still clearly remember the taxi ride from the Tullamarine Airport into the city. I sat in the front passenger seat and the three girls sat in the back. You know, of course, men always have to sit in the front of the car. The driver engaged in the usual banter on the way in, but included in this banter were questions about what our plans were for our stay in this big smoke. And I picked up on some of his innuendos about what a man I was to have three beautiful young women wearing miniskirts, all to myself for the weekend. Coming from a fairly conservative background, read Baptist, I found his take on the weekend added a sense of risque to this adventure. Heightened my saliva, perhaps. Especially considering the controversy surrounding Hair the Musical. At that time, that controversy was due to the lyrics of some of the songs and the fact that the entire cast did the full Monty for one of the scenes. All this appealed to the rebel within me, wanting to challenge the moral norms of the time. Add to this my fashion sense, body shirt, low-waisted flare trousers, big belt, and highlighted by two-tone blue boots, as well as shoulder-length hair. Where is it going? And that completes the setting for what was to follow. My mind was ripe to be exposed to some of the new ideas, the age of Aquarius. On the Saturday morning before we went to see the show, we hit the big smoke of Melbourne, mainly its shopping precinct. Everything seemed bigger, brighter and better than Adelaide. I remember one of the things that Helen bought was a hot pants suit. Who remembers the hot pants suit? Wow, you know, these very tiny shorts underneath a jacket. And in very vibrant colours, purple, orange, yellow, all those, blew my mind. This was at a time when women were just beginning to be allowed to wear pantsuits to work. During this shopping frenzy, we came across a fascinating shop selling caftans, T-shirts, incense, scarves, mainly tie-dyed. The air in the shop was heavy with incense and sitar music, added to the atmosphere. There were so many fascinating items in that shop, but the one thing that really captured my imagination was a poster of the poem Desiderata. The poster was accompanied by a brief explanation that it was discovered in old St. Paul's Church in the US in 1692. I thought, wow. This appeared to give the poem so much greater value. How truly amazing it seemed that someone about 300 years earlier could be so in touch with contemporary society of that time. It appeared that there was such a strong connection between when the poem was composed and modern times, and this signaled that the basic challenges that were being faced were, in a sense, timeless. In 1971, the poem was recorded as a spoken song by Les Crane, and it became a number one hit and achieved a Grammy Award. However, it was only last year that I learned that Desiderata was not written in the 17th century, but in 1927 by Max Ehrmann. The confusion about the poem's origin occurred when it was published by the minister of Max's church as part of a communication with his congregation. Max was born in Terre Haute, I think I've said that correctly, Indiana, to German immigrant parents, and was possibly influenced by his connection to the German Methodist Church, where he started his education. Does the discrepancy in the origin of the poem detract from its inherent messages, I wonder? Is its value diminished because it wasn't written by a 17th century person, but by a writer, poet, and attorney in the early 20th century? Well, if we look at the poem and its messages for living in contemporary society, with all its challenges and complexity, maybe it'll become a little clearer. It begins, "Go placidly among the noise and haste, and remember what peace there may be in silence." Attempting to remain calm is a challenge, isn't it? Particularly now that technology has enabled us to stay connected with the wider world more than at any other time in our evolution. In the second half of this directive, Max gives us a solution by leading us to the value and the importance of silence, and of course, meditation is an obvious way of achieving this. However, apart from this, what about the worth of simply seizing the moments we can during the day to allow ourselves to experience silence and peace? Now, I'm really talking to myself here as much as anybody else. I'm the type that gets up in the morning, goes out, gets breakfast, clicks on the television to see the ABC news. And so there's all this input coming in. I've tried it over the last couple of weeks of not doing that, just getting up, getting my breakfast and having silence, quietness while I have it. And it does feel so much better. So I'm not meditating, but I'm just taking those times of silence that are available to us and making use of them. Max then gives us some information in the poem about how to conduct our relationships with others. And of course, that's a vital part of being a community, isn't it? Max states, "As far as possible, without surrender, be on good terms with all persons. Speak your truth, listen to others, and avoid loud and aggressive people." That's fairly challenging. I mean, who gets to decide whether someone is loud and aggressive? Just as an example, last Saturday morning I had the joy of taking my 3-year-old granddaughter to the Christmas pageant. And my daughter had been into town at 6:45 and managed to get a front row position for us. And just next to where we were standing was this woman, maybe in her 60s, who every time some of the characters came near, she would yell out, "Come over here, come over here. Give me a high five, do this." And my first thing coming from judgment was, what's wrong with that woman? Why does she keep on doing that? But the people did come over and they smiled, and then they went down the line and my granddaughters all got a high five. And it just built that atmosphere. So I thought, you know, is she loud and aggressive? No, she was just being joyous and being involved in the situation. Could it be our perception of a loud and aggressive person is based on incidents from our past Possibly it is. We have the ability to control the effect that we allow others to have on us. We can't always control them. But wouldn't it be nice to be a duck, as in water on a duck's back? Just let it flow off. Here's an example of how the Dalai Lama dealt with a situation as reported by the author Howard C. Cutler. And these are his Cutler's words. I saw that as the man spoke, he became more visibly agitated. The man was saying something, but instead of responding, the Dalai Lama spontaneously took the man's hand between his, patted it gently, and for several moments simply stood there, silently nodding. The look of pain and agitation suddenly seemed to drain from the man's face. What a great outcome. Max warns us that there is danger in comparing ourselves with others. And he says that either vanity or bitterness will get us if we do. How about comparing ourselves, however, and our behaviour to the likes of the Dalai Lama, or Jesus, or Mother Teresa? Most would say that would be of benefit, wouldn't they? However, is Max talking about the more superficial things of human comparison, such as physical appearance, the type of car we drive, the house or suburb in which we live, the clothes we wear, perception of intellectual ability, and the type of work we do or the career we have? How often do we use those things as a form of comparison? Max suggests that we should keep an interest in the career that we have, however humble it may appear to us, as it has real value in that it provides an anchor in times of change. My parents encouraged me to become a teacher, particularly in a state school, as they'd been through the Great Depression and had witnessed how government employees in service areas had generally weathered the storm better shape than others in the community. So there's a lot of value in the careers that we have, not just in a monetary sense, but what it gives to us as a person. Having retired a couple of years ago, part of the adjustment was giving up that idea that I was a teacher. A past teacher, yes, but no longer a teacher, which was part of my sight. In those quieter times of our lives when we might have time for reflection, Max suggests that we ought to enjoy our achievements. A recent example of this that I had was at my granddaughter's theatre group, Constance, and that was last Sunday. In the program, a past student of mine was mentioned as one of the young adult teachers. I'd worked with her for a number of years as she had learning difficulties associated with her dyslexia. When I caught up with her after the performance, she told me that she had just completed an honours degree in education, majoring in special education. And I was a special education teacher. And that in 2018, she was moving to the Northern Territory to work with an Indigenous community. I just felt so proud and happy for her. I felt privileged to have been part of her journey and being able to contribute to what was obviously, by her enthusiasm, a great outcome. As a teacher, I found that success outcome of Year 12 students who've just finished their studies didn't simply rely on the quality of the Year 12 teachers, important as that is, but on the efforts of many who had been involved in that student's life to that particular point in time. However, I felt that this was such a successful outcome for this girl, of which I'd played a part, and it gives me such joy and a sense of fulfillment still just thinking about it, even though I'm no longer involved in that game. From reflection about my association with the student, I was reminded of wisdom I came across in the 80s, and that was to set your plans in sand, but your goals in concrete. So she had always, obviously held a desire to be a teacher, but because of her learning difficulties, the path wasn't a simple one for her. She had to work in a different way to get there and had to change that path very often. Possibly Max is asking us not to merely celebrate those times we achieve a goal, but also to enjoy the process of getting to the goal. In planning, we can overlook those life events that directly affect the plans. What we do about the challenges is an opportunity, I believe, for character development. If we adopt the attitude that mistakes are as valuable in our learning process as successes, this could lead to a greater sense of enjoyment in the journey towards our goals. If you are cursed by the affliction of perfectionism, the journey when faced with making a mistake can be pretty tough. This is not to say that having high expectations is bad. Thank goodness that many people do, no matter what their career, profession or work, and that they strive for higher goals. But it does come at a cost sometimes. Max then entreats us not to become cynical about life or humanity. He acknowledges the darker side of the human psyche, but challenges us not to dwell on this, but instead focus on the good that surrounds us. The media loves to promote sporting personalities, doesn't it? To the ranks of heroism. How often do you hear, he was a hero, he got that goal, he fought his way through or whatever. And some certainly might be heroes. Gillian Rolton is one who comes to mind particularly in her pursuit of a gold medal in the, I think it was the Barcelona Olympics. It might have been the Atlanta. However, there are so many acts of heroism that often go unnoticed, as the persons involved often don't seek glorification. They're simply being true to themselves, living life with integrity. Many of their acts are driven by love. Love, it seems, such a loosely used word at times, and yet it's such a basically important part of our humanity. It is diminished, if restricted in definition, to only one of its many forms, that is romantic love. In all its forms, it connects us to a better world, and Max reminds us that this is as perennial as the grass. Then the next three statements taken from the poem perhaps are directed more towards the older age group, but I think it can be applied to a fairly broad range of ages. The first one, he says, take kindly the counsel of the years, gracefully surrendering the things of youth. Secondly, nurture strength of spirit. Be gentle with yourself. And thirdly, don't distress yourself with imaginings. Many fears are born out of fatigue and loneliness. Now, the first one, take kindly the counsel of the years, can be quite a challenge, particularly when you consider things like having to surrender your physical mobility and other health issues which are associated with ageing. The operative word in that, I think, is gracefully. My mother provided a great example of this. When it was necessary for her to move into a nursing home, at the age of 92, she cried all the way from her home to the nursing home. However, when she was greeted by the director and shown her room, she became quite positive. And a couple of days later, she told me how happy she was, and in a strange way, that this new place seemed like home. When leaving her for a few weeks later to travel, I told her that I felt bad about it, having to leave her. She simply smiled and said that she was perfectly happy where she was and she had made new friends to share time with and not to worry about her. You're such a worrywart, John. Don't worry about it. A few days before she died, shortly before her 96th birthday, she was struggling with her health but told me, I have lived too long, I am too tired, and I am ready to go. She was surrendering her life gracefully. The second point is something that really applies to all age groups, and that was nurturing strength of spirit and being gentle with yourself. But it's particularly challenging as you age, and you can no longer do the things that perhaps you once did with efficiency. The poem challenges us to be gentle with ourselves. The world may not always treat you with patience and kindness, and at times you can feel like an invisible person as you age, particularly as you walk among a crowd, maybe down the Rundle Mall. You may not be able to change how others view you, but you can change how you view yourself. Loneliness and tiredness are not the sole domains for the aging and elderly. Of course, these conditions apply to any age group. However, they are major issues for the older members of our society, particularly when they become isolated from family and friends. Naturally, many fears and worries occur when we are lonely and tired. However, as Max writes, we shouldn't allow these concerns to distress us. But how to achieve this? Marianne Williamson says, "Our fear will be cast out as we once more begin to respect it," meaning age. She suggests that the whole of society has a role to play here in developing kinder, more considerate ways of dealing with the elderly, as well as acknowledging the wisdom of their years. The last section of Desiderata leads open possibilities for a good deal of discussion. Particularly, you are a child of the universe, no less than the trees and the stars. You have a right to be here, Max states. Consider this in the light of Australia's handling of refugees, as well as the many other countries where human rights are abused, and the reverse of that statement is practiced. What are we saying? You don't have a right to be here? And that happens so often, doesn't it, through the actions of our governments. The flip side of rights, however, is responsibility. So many times when I was teaching, young people would voice their dreams of the rights they would have when they achieved adult status or were old enough to gain a driver's license. I'll be free. I'll be able to do this. I'll be able to do that. I would endeavour to get them to consider the responsibilities that were attached to the freedoms they imagined. As members of any society, it appears that it is a fine balancing act between rights and responsibilities. I like John F. Kennedy's mantra, "Don't ask what the world can do for me, but what I can do for the world." What appeals to me about this poem is the sense of hope it encourages at the end, stating that whether we understand it or not, the universe is unfolding as it should. We are then reminded to be at peace with God, whatever that means to you, whatever you conceive God to be, and keep peace with your soul, and to remember that with everything that diminishes our concept of the planet, it is still a beautiful world. It appears that Max has set out to define a set of beatitudes that are ideals, if practiced, would improve the quality of our human existence. Naturally, like all poems, it's open to interpretation by the reader, and here is the writer for this address. The proceeding that I've just spoken about is simply my impressions and interpretation. You're entitled to make up your own mind and interpretations. The value of the poem to me is that its effect on me has not diminished since my pseudo-hippie days of the 70s, and I'm still waiting for the age of Aquarius to occur.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianessay@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching Essay Unitarians.